Next case this morning is Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation against Ernst & Young. Mr. Richmond.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The FDIC in its corporate capacity is here today seeking reversal of the judgment dismissing its claims solely on the basis that the FDIC in its corporate capacity lacks standing. That judgment must be reversed because the FDIC in its corporate capacity meets all of the requirements for standing, all of the traditional elements, and no valid basis exists for denying the FDIC standing in this capacity.
You know, in the in your brief, you repeatedly argue that the FDIC suit will not impair the statutory receivership priority scheme because the FDIC has voluntarily pledged that it will follow that scheme in this case. Does that mean that standing will be lacking in a future case where no such voluntary assurance might be forthcoming?
No, Your Honor. I think that you would begin with looking at the elements of standing, which are, of course, separate from the merits of the case. And if those elements are met, as they are in this case, then there would be standing.
Right. That's why I wonder, so, I mean, about this argument, because if the scheme is, you know, if the scheme's relevant to the standing determination as a matter of law, why should it matter, you know, whether the FDIC decides to follow the scheme in a particular case?
The FDIC, first of all, that scheme is public policy in the United States, so there's no reason really why it wouldn't be followed here. The FDIC, I believe, our position is that it isn't really relevant to the question of standing, which is the only question that was the only basis for the reversal. An issue was made of it, and FDIC in its corporate capacity looked at that and said, there's not a reason in the world why we wouldn't follow that scheme. So if that's your objection, if that's your argument against standing, that can be dealt with quickly. It will be followed. So in this case, and of course standing is a case-by-case, fact-intensive determination, in this case, the question of impairment of the statutory scheme is simply not here. There isn't going to be any impairment of the statutory scheme, of the priority scheme. And beyond that, if the court looks at the statutory scheme as a whole, we have an outcome in this case which will be identical to the outcome had receiver recovered these funds. The payments will go pursuant to the same structure. Those who are entitled to benefit will benefit. There is no inconsistency at all in allowing the FDIC to sue in this capacity, in this case.
What substantive claim is the FDIC vindicating?
Well, the substantive claims, we have advanced three claims under Illinois law, resting upon duties that the FDIC alleges run to the FDIC in its corporate capacity. And those duties are to provide accurate audits, and that because...
No. What substantive duty is the FDIC, alleging? Your brief is... Here's why I ask. Your brief is kind of straddling between saying what we're really bringing is a subrogation claim on behalf of the depositors, and on the other hand saying we're bringing a claim that is unique to FDIC corporate, and nobody else has it. If the former, we need to explore who these depositors are and to what extent Illinois law allows subrogation. If the latter, there's a serious problem under O'Melveny against Myers that we need to explore. So we've got to choose one of these paths to go down. And as I say, your brief doesn't clearly choose. Your brief reads like it's trying to have things both ways.
We did not intend that, Your Honor. We are not, it is not our position that corporate is advancing, in essence, the claims of receiver. Corporate is advancing claims that it believes run directly to it. separate claims.
So you say you are not pursuing a subrogation claim?
That's correct, because that would be an assigned claim. These are claims for damages, a standalone claim, not a... Well, yes, in a sense, yeah, of course, because... We, I'm sorry, Your Honor, of course, it is a subrogated claim because the payments are made...
I'm trying to have things both ways.
No,
would
no.
you kindly tell me what your claim is?
Okay, the claim is that the money was paid to the depositors, and we are... That is the damage to the safe, and that is the claim we are asserting.
So it's a subrogation claim. Under Illinois law, under what circumstances could the depositors collect from the accountant?
The depositors would have, it would be, I may have gotten into, it is not a claim that the depositors could bring. It is a claim resting upon...
So then it's not a subrogation claim. As you see, one of the problems in winning here is that if you cannot articulate what your own legal theory is, you'll have a hard time persuading us that your legal theory is correct.
One thing that you've argued is that the injury to the SAIF is an injury, in fact, that you can redress. Are you the only entity that could file suit on behalf of the SAIF for an injury to the SAIF?
No, Your Honor.
So what other entities would have standing based on the injury to...
Well, receiver, in the receivership capacity, FDIC as a receiver could bring such a claim as well. There are other potential plaintiffs. We have not asserted that corporate is the only plaintiff. But the injury to the fund is money that was paid out by the fund. So it is not a claim that is, it is not the depositor's claim that the FDIC is asserting. It is the claim for harm to the fund, which the FDIC asserts in its corporate capacity.
Well, is it based on the harm to the depositors so that the FDIC, by paying the claims, acquires the depositors' claims? That's a standard subrogation.
No, Your Honor, I apologize.
It's not that.
It is a claim.
But if your theory is that we have a claim that is different or distinct from the depositors, then you're just smack into O'Melveny against Myers. Sorry, O'Melveny and Myers.
I believe that goes to the question of whether corporate would have a cause of action. Do the causes of action under Illinois law, are they real causes of action? The question presently before the court, I believe, is simply the question of standing. Taking the complaint and the facts in the complaint is true, is corporate an appropriate party to bring this controversy to the court?
I'd like to go back to my question, please, because it seems to me that it's fairly clear that it is a better fit for the FDIC to sue as a receiver. And it would seem that you may have chosen this route to avoid certain defenses that would be available to Ernst & Young in such a suit.
Your Honor, that is certainly a factor. Indeed, in 1992, the FDIC brought a claim against Ernst & Young in the receivership capacity and lost on the grounds that it had sued in the wrong capacity. And Ernst & Young suggested, and the Fifth Circuit took it essentially as a given, that had the FDIC sued in the capacity of suing in this case, that it could have had standing.
Yes, but O'Melveny and Myers came 2 years later.
But, Your Honor, I don't think that goes to the question of... It goes to the creation of causes of action. And we allege causes of action that are state law causes of action that are in existence. There's no new creation of any causes of action. Of course, the parties will disagree on whether the FDIC can sustain those causes of action, but it's not creating any new causes of action.
Well, describe somebody other than the FDIC who would bring this claim under state law.
Under state law, it could be difficult to find someone other than the FDIC. But it doesn't mean the FDIC can't, that the FDIC can't be a plaintiff under this, under these state laws.
But I don't understand what state law there is if there are no examples of it in existence.
I'm not sure that that's correct, Your Honor. The Hoopers and Librand case was an example of a corporate entity suing on essentially the same types of claims being brought here. And standing was found in that case. It was suggested that standing could have been, could have existed in the Ernst & Young case. The fact that it is not a common root doesn't constitute a legal argument why it can't be pursued in a particular case.
Let me try one more variation. What is the Illinois case that gives you the most help in saying that there is a claim that of the kind now being pursued? What state case would that
be? I guess that would be the Rosny case, Your Honor, which says that the party does not need to be a technical third-party beneficiary in order to sue if you're in that zone of reasonable reliance. And in this case, that reasonable reliance is established
who
by the...
Who were the plaintiffs in Rosny?
The plaintiffs in Rosny were, I believe, people who bought a house and there was a dispute over a land survey. But, of course, the cases that the Illinois Supreme Court looked to for that rule were accountant cases.
I'm now lost. I would have thought Rosny might establish the principle in Illinois that the depositors had a claim against the accountants. But you've already told me that the FDIC is not trying to step into the shoes of the depositors. It's not suing on a subrogation theory.
That's right.
So how do you take advantage of Rosny?
Because
the injured parties are the depositors or anybody who paid them off.
We are the ones, the corporate is the ones who paid them.
But then you would be making a subrogation claim.
I don't think that's necessarily, Your Honor, let's assume there was a federal statute.
The only way you can sue on the depositor's claim is to be subrogated to their rights on the ground that you paid them off. I understand that theory. Now, of course, maybe that's a claim owned by FDIC receiver, but at least I understand that theory. I don't understand your argument that this is the claim you're pursuing, but it's not the depositor's claim to which the FDIC is subrogated.
The FDIC's claim is that the federal statutes that we've cited create a duty from Ernst & Young to the FDIC in its corporate capacity. Those duties were violated. The result was injury, and those are the claims the FDIC is suing on. Those are the claims alleged in our complaint.
Now it sounds like you say the claim is based on some kind of federal common law. It can't be federal statute law because you haven't pointed to a federal statute that gives the FDIC a right to money damages. If it's a federal common law claim, that's why I say you've now run smack into O'Melveny and Myers.
Our claim is that the duty is created by the federal statutes. The cause of action are state law causes of action. The question, we will come back to the fact that if you look at the outcome of this case, again, coming back to the question, which was the principal basis of the district court's ruling of the impairment of the statutory scheme, that impairment is not going to occur in this case, principally because of the undertaking of FDIC corporate. And because of that, the result in this case will look exactly the same as if under the statutory scheme that the court seemed to prefer, and for that reason, the principal basis for the finding of no standing cannot stand. I see that my white light is on, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Richmond.
Good morning. May it please the court, Michelle Odorizzi for Ernst & Young. The difficulty that the court was having with counsel for the FDIC is precisely the difficulty we've had throughout this case. The FDIC has been groping for some kind of rationale where they can sue in their corporate capacity rather than suing as they have always done before as the receiver of Superior Bank.
Well, if the FDIC can't sue to redress the injury to the SAF, who can?
Well,
who can?
The way the statute works is that the FDIC as receiver has the rights of the failed institution, depositors, stockholders. It has the rights of the failed institution, depositors, and stockholders. There's a specific statutory provision that gives the receiver those rights. And the statute clearly contemplates that the FDIC as receiver will bring claims against third parties, directors, officers, outside accounting firms, if that's appropriate, to redress the harm that they have suffered, no matter what state law claims they may have suffered. And the way the FDIC fund, the way the safe gets its money out, is that the FDIC is subrogated to the rights of the insured depositors against the failed institution, but only subrogated to the rights against the failed institution.
Well, no, unfortunately, it doesn't say only, it just says...
It says against the failed
institution. It says they're subrogated to the rights mm-hmm. against the failed institution, but there's no other statute that says, and that's the only thing they can be subrogated to.
There is not. There's not an express prohibition. However, the FDIC as receiver is given the rights of depositors with respect to the assets in the institution. And that would indicate, and the FDIC has in fact, in some cases, sued on behalf of depositors. So that would suggest that it is the receiver that has whatever rights the depositors might have against third parties. And in fact, as to uninsured depositors, the FDIC agrees with us that uninsured depositors cannot bring these claims, that the claims must be brought by the receiver. And to go back to how the safe gets its money, it puts in a claim against the estate. When the receiver recovers money from any third parties, it goes to the estate and it flows through the statutory priority scheme. And because the FDIC is subrogated to the claims of insured depositors, it gets the benefit of the depositor preference that Congress enacted into law, so that it takes before general creditors of the estate take.
Does Illinois treat the depositor's suit as direct or as derivative?
Well, it would depend. What the cases that have said uninsured depositors don't have the authority to sue, they treat it as a derivative claim.
There are two separate questions here which the parties' briefs kind of tangle up. Mm-hmm. One is whether the claim is direct or derivative.
Right.
That is, whether there's a direct injury to the depositors or only an injury to the institution which has to be pursued by the depositors derivative. The second is whether the claim is individual or collective. That is, can it be brought by an individual depositor, or does it have to be brought by somebody on their behalf collectively, perhaps by a receiver? But that's different from direct versus derivative. And my question was, does Illinois treat this kind of claim as a direct claim or as a derivative claim?
I don't believe there is any Illinois law on that subject. We've not seen any Illinois law on that subject.
Rodney seems to contemplate a direct claim as opposed to a derivative claim. And I ask this because everything gets tangled up from the receiver's perspective in the arbitration clause.
Right.
The arbitration clause is going to apply if the claim is derivative. It's not going to apply if the claim is direct. Right. So FDIC receiver could bring this without regard to the arbitration clause if the depositor's claim is direct and it can be brought collectively.
I don't believe it's a direct claim because in Rosny, it was a direct claim. That's a surveyor case, by the way, but in Rosny, it was a direct claim because the individual person who was bringing the claim could claim to have relied on the surveyor's certification. And here, you don't have any claim that the depositor...
That's a different question, what's necessary to win, right?
But it also, the harm here is harm from the failure of the institution. That's the claim, that our deposits could not be paid because the institution failed. And therefore, I think it is a derivative claim. That is certainly how the courts that have said depositors don't have standing to sue and that the claim belongs to the receiver have treated these claims. The Popkin case, which we cite in our brief, treats them as derivative.
Is there any reason to believe that Illinois follows Popkin?
There's no reason to believe that it would treat it any differently.
As I view Popkin, the question is not direct versus derivative, but individual versus collective. But in any event, we don't know. Have Illinois courts ever cited Popkin or discussed that?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
It's awfully hard to take the Third Circuit as a particularly good indicator of the meaning of state law. Usually we look, if Illinois doesn't have it, we look and see what Indiana or Wisconsin or
but in this
what
case,
other state did.
In this case, the FDIC has not said, and in fact, counsel says, they are not suing, they are not attempting to stand in the shoes of the insured depositors to bring this lawsuit.
But of course I couldn't exactly tell where the FDIC is attempting to stand, since everywhere I thought they were standing, they told me they were actually someplace else.
Their theory has been that the FDIC, as a regulator, was the one that was misled into not taking any action with respect to Superior, and that is why the institution failed. And that kind of a claim does, as Your Honor said, run smack into O'Melveny.
I didn't think they were, maybe this is just the problem with trying to figure out what they're claiming. I didn't think they were claiming that it was in their role as a regulator. It was in their role as the administrator of all the money.
Well, it's really that they would have done something, and they've never said what it is, but their claim is that there is a duty of care somehow running from Ernst & Young to the FDIC, and it's really in their role as a regulator because they say they would have done something to shut down the institution earlier or to stop it engaging in these securitization transactions.
Isn't the argument more that the FDIC is the administrative arm of the SAIS, and so it has the statutory duty to administer, control, and maintain the SAIS? That's what I got, anyway.
Well, I don't know that would give them any right to sue. And the difficulty with it is that the FDIC...
Well, if there's an injury to the SAIS, then it can sue to redress the injury to the SAIS. I mean, I think that's what their argument is.
Well, I think that is what their argument is, but the problem is...
To the extent it's a subrogation right.
Well, but they don't say they're suing segregated to the rights of the insured depositors. And why should the insured depositors be able to sue if the uninsured depositors have to rely on the receivers to bring
because
a lawsuit?
It's only the insured depositors who the fund paid out on account of. Right? The subrogation right depends on paying out on the claim, and then you get the claim that otherwise could have been made. A claim that the FDIC didn't pay on, it couldn't be subrogated to.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. But all I'm saying is that uninsured depositors, the Popkin case says it, and the FDIC agrees with us, that an uninsured depositor has to rely on the FDIC as receiver to bring a lawsuit against third parties. And then you have the recovery flowing through the estate rather than every man for himself going out and all depositors bringing a host of different lawsuits against third parties. And that's the way the statutory scheme is set up. I think O'Melveny is relevant in another sense, and that is, in O'Melveny, the FDIC argued that the powers that it was given in this very complex statute were really non-exclusive powers, and that the court ought to use federal common law to apply, to imply additional federal defenses just for the FDIC. And that's really what they're trying to say here. There is a statutory scheme. It all hangs together. It works where the safe gets its money by having the receiver sue third parties. But the FDIC says, we don't want to do it that way because Ernst & Young has
a suit with Let me ask you what may seem an odd question, but what seems to me a similar question. Can the administrator of the Medicare program sue the tobacco industry? Right? We pay out on these medical claims, and we're now subrogated to the rights of the people who we paid out. We now claim the right to bring this lawsuit.
If they're bringing a subrogation claim, they might be able to. Yes.
Right, but the FDIC has disclaimed the subrogation.
They've disclaimed it, but in addition, here you have the added layer of having a receivership in place, where the idea is that the receiver is supposed to be marshaling the assets of the estate.
The receiver is marshaling the assets of the institution, But you wouldn't be arguing that if there were, if the bank had bought, suppose the bank just bought insurance in the private market, right? There's some banks that buy private insurance, some mutual funds that buy private insurance. The private insurer pays off, steps into the shoes of the claims and tries to recover for the private insurance fund. I trust you wouldn't be arguing that it couldn't do that, that only FDIC receiver could bring a lawsuit and the private insurer was locked out.
It's subjugated to the rights of the party. Of the
private insurer would have, and it wouldn't be squeezed out by FDIC receiver. But that raised, at least in my mind, the question why FDIC corporate, as the public insurer, wouldn't have the same claim a private insurer would have, independent of FDIC receiver.
Well,
but I gather FDIC corporate is not making that argument.
And
that's my latest.
If they are not making that argument, they've never made that argument. Plus, the statute gives the FDIC as receiver the right not only of the failed institution, but also of depositors with respect to the assets of the failed institution. And that's deliberate on Congress's part because they want the FDIC as receiver to be bringing these claims. They don't want a lot of different parties going out and bringing different claims. And here, when you have a statutory construct that's as complex as this one is, what O'Melveny says is don't go around implying additional rights and additional remedies on behalf of the FDIC, because doing that doesn't just supplement the statutory scheme, it fundamentally alters it. And that's what the FDIC is trying to do here, because it doesn't like the dispute resolution provisions of E&Y's agreement with Superior Bank. And that cannot supply a reason for going around this complex statute. In the in O'Melveny, the court said...
Is it, by the way, agreed that FDIC receiver would be subject to the arbitration clause?
No. They've purported to repudiate it.
I'm not worried about repudiation. I'm just worried about whether it's subject to it at all. And what I'm thinking about is EEOC against Waffle House, where the Supreme Court held that an EEOC suit on behalf of private employees, supposedly subjects of discrimination, was not subject to an arbitration clause entered into freely between the employer and the employee. Right, it was a suit by the EEOC on behalf of the employees, and the Supreme Court said, nonetheless, not subject to the arbitration clause. Wouldn't that be equally true of FDIC receiver?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because if you look at O'Melveny, you're talking about, really, you step into the shoes of the failed institution. And if they're bringing a claim on behalf of the institution...
The EEOC was bringing a claim on behalf of, you know, stepping into the shoes of, it had no greater right than the employees did. But the Supreme Court said it nonetheless had a right to litigate in federal court. Mm-hmm. But that was something that went with being the EEOC.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I'm asking is, isn't that equally true of being the FDIC?
Well, in O'Melveny, the court says you cannot give the FDIC special rights that are not explicitly granted by Congress and apply federal rights.
Well, Melvin's dealing with substance. We're dealing here with procedure. Mm-hmm. That an arbitration clause is a venue choice. And it may be that federal agencies have their own venue choices independent of what the private parties do, even though they still have only the same substantive rights. Did anybody argue Waffle House in the district court?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, the issue of whether the FDIC as receiver is bound to the arbitration clause is an issue that Judge Gettleman said really has to be left for another day if they choose to sue as receiver.
Yeah.
We'd ask the court to affirm the judgment.
Thank you, Ms. Odorizzi. Anything further, Mr. Richmond?
The argument that the statutory scheme is so comprehensive and that precludes the FDIC from suing here. The FDIC has a sue-and-be-sued clause, broad authority. We think that the issue should be, is there a restriction? No restriction has ever been pointed to say that at the outset, in a case that alleges an injury in fact and meets the other requirements of standing, that the FDIC has no standing, is the wrong party, that this is a not concrete enough argument to be adjudicated by the court. And given the history of this statute, which has been to broaden the powers for recovery to the fund, and given the outcome in this case, which would be the same as the statutory structure that Ernst & Young says should prevail, there is no reason why the FDIC shouldn't be allowed to attempt to prove its claims because it has standing. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.